You guys,
well, you're still part of the young philatelists.
Yes, I am.
Yes. Anyone under 50 is under a 50. Young philatelist. And
they have to belong to the APS.
But here's the interesting thing. The young philatelists that are all the way up to 50 represent 5% of the APS membership.
Yeah, so I saw that.
95% of the APS membership is over the age of 50.
Yeah, 50 and above.
How scary is that? And
it's not scary. It's sad.
It really is.
No, it's not.
C, all the above.
No, it is sad because nobody under the age of 50 is interested in joining the APS.
Why?
Yeah, because there's a bunch of people over the age of 50.
A bunch of old people.
Yeah.
Well, if more young people joined, then I wouldn't be alone. Or you and I wouldn't be alone.
At the entire Hartford show, how many people were eligible for that? Maybe.
Well, I don't know.
30, 50?
The group we had was close to 40 that were there.
And I think that was every single person who was eligible.
No.
And some people even came in from out of
the show.
No, some people came in from out of town.
Yeah,
specifically
well,
for that.
I did.
Well, what do you
for the
think,
dinner?
What do you think there are fewer of, people under the age of 50 in the APS or women in the APS?
Oh boy, that's a tough call.
Touche.
Yeah.
Well, we have Jessica here, so
to the statistics.
Jessica,
did you join yet?
Are you an APS member?
Jeff is. I'm waiting for his confirmation, and I can join as a spouse.
Get the spousal discount.
Oh well, yeah.
Well, it's like $20.
Okay. Spouses.
I can hear the crickets.
I'm thinking everyone, all the female members must all be spouses.
That's funny because that's actually kind of how it was put to me when the idea got brought up.
Now I got to join on my own just to prove them wrong.
Oh, no. There's some. Who is it? The who's the one from San Jose who's she's part of the board of directors?
Kristen Patterson.
Yeah. She's.
I don't think she's a spouse.
She's under 50. She's a woman, and she's.
She refused to come to the meeting.
Which
of
one?
The young friends of the APS
at Riverside.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I didn't see her there. Did you?
Because they're all young men waiting to hit on.
No,
her.
Riverside hasn't.
No, Hartford.
She walks
in
there.
There.
Was she?
Oh yeah, she.
I know she went to the show. I didn't see her at the dinner.
No, she was absolutely there. I wouldn't know that she was under 50 and a woman.
Oh,
and part of this, she was not at that dinner.
Talk about an outlier.
Yeah, wow. I mean,
woman under 50 that's not a spouse.
5% of 5%. Wow, that's amazing. Actually, I think there was a pretty good mix of men and women.
There was a good mix of men and women. There are many more younger women than there are younger men.
Ha
No, I think it's pretty close, but compared to the general population.
Well, compared to the general population of the APS, absolutely.
It's all white men who live in the Northeast. and
are octogenarians.
Yes, and they are octogenarians. But for the young philatelists, it's a pretty diverse group.
Well, 5% of 5% is 0.25%, so that's saying that 99.75% of APS members are not women under 50 who are not spouses.
Here's the interesting thing. The 5% who are women are also the 5% who are under 50. There's a huge crossover in that 5%.
Well, yeah. I disagree, though, because really we're not talking about stamp collecting.
Of the young
We're
friends.
Talking about who wants to join a stamp society.
This
came up when Bill Lytle wrote his article showing that, you know, the stamp, the membership of the APS is getting older. It's like, okay, fine. You know what? It's remarkable how few 90-year-olds play World of Warcraft. How do we get more 90-year-olds to play World of Warcraft? And the answer is, it's
chain
a different,
them to the chair.
It's a different demographic group.
Take away their walker.
Yeah.
I think you'd see a lot more younger people in these the chat boards on eBay.
Oh yeah,
all of those places. I bet the average age is well under 50.
Yeah, go find the median age of sellers on eBay. I guarantee it's under 40.
Oh, I guarantee.
Yeah, it's probably
lower
it's probably
than that.
Closer. I would. Well, no, because there's a few. you get one or two people who are you get one or two people who are 60 and suddenly you skew the population. I'd say it's probably around 40, 45, something like that.
Well, but you have people like Stanley Piller.
Is this being recorded?
He has other people listing for him. So
yes.
You have Stanley Piller's inventory being sold by the person who puts it on eBay for him. And I know Bill Langs, he has somebody else do a lot of his inputting.
Yes.
I think it's his son, isn't it?
No.
Somebody else?
Okay. No, it's...
a bunch of 20-somethings.
Yeah.
But even Eddie Younger, he uses a gentleman who's, I think, in his maybe late 40s or late 30s, early 40s, something like that. I can't think of anybody who sells on eBay who doesn't have the person selling on eBay who's somewhere between their 40s and 50s.
Right, yeah. And you would expect that. Whereas if you deal with a stamp society that has a very, very old, long history. I mean, younger people don't care about the long history of the APS. As a matter of fact, younger people would see the long history of the APS as a negative, not a positive. And so when you say that APS membership is 95% 50 and above, it's sort of that's who they market to. How many 18-year-olds want Cadillacs for their first car? None. Very few. You know, it's where they market. So the APS gets the people who they're looking for. And who they're looking for is who they get. I mean, that's a basic law of economics. If you want to see who a company is targeting, look at who their customers are.
So let me ask you, APS, the average age, 50 plus, blah, 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 is well over 50. Does that mean that the future of the hobby is dead when all these people die? Or does that mean that the people who, not the future of the hobby. Does that mean APS is dead when all these people die?
No.
Or does that mean that
APS is going to get more 50-year-old people to join their society? If you want to know, again, you know, I just said it. If you want to know who they're targeting, look at who they have. If they're targeting 50-year-olds, that's who they're going to get, and that's who they have. You will expect the APS to always have 50-year-olds joining their society. It doesn't reflect stamp collecting. It reflects APS. Just like eBay doesn't reflect stamp collecting, eBay reflects eBay.
Go to eBay, type in postage stamp, and hit search. There's like 5 million hits.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Well, I think the Young Friends of the APS is a good motivator to get younger people to go, and it's primarily a social driver, not just of younger people who like stamps to hang out together. And that's the one benefit that I find. That's the actually, for me, the biggest benefit of being a member of the APS is being able to just hang out with other people that are closer to my age instead of 30, 40 years older than me.
And that is the marketing of the APS. The APS says, let's try to get younger people. We will set up this subgroup of APS membership and try to get that to grow. Totally understandable. They're going into a different market. It's to be expected. But the market that they're looking for.
I think it's a smart move.
Yeah.
I think it's a smart move.
Because the APS needs more people.
And, people that listen to this podcast are going to be in that younger group. And if you want to hang out and talk stamps, you'd like to hear us talk about stamps, you want to talk about stamps, come to one of these bigger shows and look for the people that are part of that.
I can speak from personal experience, semi-related with pins. There were two groups of people. Were the old-time fogies that hauled around $100,000 worth of Disney pins to the park, which is absurd. Then there was a younger group of people. Well, the younger group of people started their own pin forum, their own blogs online. And when it came time, let's see, we had basically the equivalent of a pin show. And at the end of the pin show, everybody that was part of the forum said, hey, let's go hang out. Well, then the room went like this, and you had all the old-timers who were not part of the forum that didn't show up everybody that came as part of the forum was under 30. So you start accessing things like digital forums and whatnot, you are going past that age gap.
That's absolutely what I was going to say. It's, you know, the target audience for this podcast is absolutely not the same as the target audience mm-hmm. for the APS.
In fact, we blasted on the forum, hey, let's have a forum party. Let's see who all shows up. And that's exactly what happened. Everybody that showed up was under 30.
Yeah.
And we all realized, oh, holy crap, it's just the young people that are part of this. So, yeah.
You want to know something? We've been talking a long time. Why don't we go ahead and do a countdown so that we can start this? Otherwise, okay. We're going to have a two-hour show.
I know.
Oh, and Jeff, I think we should keep a big majority of what we were talking about there in it.
Yeah. That is going to be the longest pre.
That's going to be like the longest prelude to the show ever.
There we go.
Yeah, at some point you should be like, holy crap, we're supposed to be doing a show.
Well, that's why I added that in. Yeah.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It's a to send up. Welcome to Stamp Show here today. I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, Brian, and Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. So let's talk about stamps. All right, this week we'll be talking about stamp news, stamp collecting history, Admiral Zhang He, updates, stamp stories, Thanksgiving, and our expert topic of the week will be forgotten rarities. So let's start with some stamp news. The United States Postal Service has been hacked. Well, it finally happened. The USPS has been hacked. Some people believe this may be part of a silent cyberspace cold war facing the internet today. Edward Fiera, an analyst with the technology research company named Forrester, said, quote, everyone realizes that the next true conflict that's going to be fought is going to be launched not with artillery barrage, but a cyber barrage, end quote. While it seems that the dear old post office might be quite an unimportant target, it makes good practice for the hackers against the government agency and may provide information on high-level employees that are involved in other branches of government work as well as the USPS. This type of data has lately been referred to as, quote, seed data, and some of the best kinds come from important places. The unaware consumer is far more likely to open a phishing scam email from the postmaster of the USPS versus an old-fashioned, we all know this one, Nigerian print scam that requires you to give up your social and date of birth. One main concern, of course, is the source of the attacks. Some speculate that it may have originated from China. I just think it's amazing that when the NSA does it, it's for national security. And when China does it, it's espionage. I'm not sure I understand the difference. So what do you guys think about this? The old world versus the new hacking.
I want to know if they know where all of the uninverted Jenny sheets are.
Oh, the post office keeps careful track of where they sent them, and they've all been shipped to China.
Oh, they are.
No, they've been rerouted to China.
Rerouted to, yeah, they didn't even have to pay for it.
Did it say where they hacked them? I mean, did they get like their...
Well,
they were able to go in and change all the prices of 49-cent stamps to 52 cents or something, or...
Well, it was mainly just to garner data. Mm. So they wanted the highest officials they could get, and looked like they had sent an email out saying, hey, we lost your Social Security number. Can you send it to us again? Or something like that, I'm sure. And yeah. People will open it.
Okay.
Well, sometimes some of these hacks can just simply be they broke into it and maybe played around to just learn how the network was done. They discovered the hack and then go live with it.
Yeah, a lot of times it's just to say, ta-da, we did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, that's why the person did the U.S. Army one, to just show that he could do it.
Yeah.
Didn't you say there's some statistic about hacking?
Oh, yeah. They say there's two different types of companies. Companies that have been hacked. And companies that have been hacked but don't know it.
Yet,
yeah. So who knows?
Well, how long did that Target credit card hack go on? I think that was a couple months that They were being hacked, and they didn't know it for a long time.
And then did you hear
denied it for how many more months on top of that? Yeah.
But did you hear the end of that story?
No.
The person who hacked him, he just didn't do anything with the data. They figure he stole like $2,000 worth of stuff or something like that. He had access to the entire Target database, and he walked away with $2,000.
Well, it's like I took my dog to the park, and this is a true story, and there are ducks all over the park. She's a big lab mix. She ran around for an hour like crazy chasing these ducks, chasing them and chasing them. She finally caught one, and we were terrified what she's going to do to this duck. And she just kind of stood there with it, like, now what? So he hacked it, and okay, I did it. Now what do I do?
Yeah. Could very well be the case, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have Jeff read this next segment. Could you look up all the proper pronunciations of the names? And the article that we got this from came out of the China Clipper.
Okay, stamp collecting and history. This week's stamp collecting and history segment is inspired by an article by Dennis Murphy called Admiral Zheng He. In recognition of the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday, we would like to introduce you to an alternative to the traditional discovery of North America. Around 600 years ago, Chinese Admiral Zheng He sailed the Great Ming Armada from Nanjing in search of wealth, treasure, and loyalty for then-Emperor Zhu Di, third emperor of the Ming Dynasty. Admiral He set sail for India and Africa nearly 100 years before Vasco da Gama ever set foot on African soil. This fact has been known for quite some time, but there is a theory that may just have gained some proof to the tale. A world map dated 1763 that accurately depicts the Americas has been found with a corner note that states the map is in fact a copy from one made by the fleet of Admiral He in 1418. This would mean that an accurate map of the Americas existed 74 years before the first voyage of Columbus, and that historically the first, quote, official discovery of the Americas belongs to a Chinese admiral and not Spain. The map has been sent to a firm in New Zealand for carbon dating and for authentication, and if proved correct, history books will have to be rewritten. Sorry, Chris Columbus, maybe we should be celebrating Admiral He Day instead. You can see the impressive commemorative sheetlets, PRC numbers 1992 through 1995, issued in 1985 on our Facebook and Twitter.
Oh boy, that means my Columbus souvenir sheets are going to be worthless now.
That mean all the Columbus, Ohio, Columbia, all those places are going to suddenly have to be
Zheng He, Ohio? No, one thing that I wanted to point out was that Leif Erikson, he supposedly discovered America in the year 1001.
Well, he discovered Canada.
Beats both of these guys. And there was a caveman named Oot.
Oot,
who he discovered it about 15,000 years ago. So we should have Oot Day or Leif Erikson Day or Columbus Day or just say, hey.
America Day?
America Day. There you go.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of his exploration, they actually started colonies. They found a shipwreck of a junk off of California coast that they've dated to match up.
Supposedly.
No, what they found, I think it was off the coast of Catalina, they discovered a lot of anchors. There was a certain round, I think it looked kind of like a wheel anchor. But the problem is you can't date those. And I think they were still using the same type of anchors in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So when Chinese fishing vessels or barges would come across from China, they would drop their anchor, and rather than pull their anchor back up and go across, they just cut it and go back. So you had hundreds of these anchors, and you can't date stone.
You don't know when they came from.
Yeah, you have no idea. So it's
But the other thing is, supposedly what happened is Zheng had this huge armada, and the emperor said, "Go," and so he just shot off everywhere. And you would expect that. You would expect him to discover a whole bunch of places. But if you don't document it and you don't settle it, who cares?
Well, one of the things that was in the article is that a bunch of the documentation was destroyed as China kept going through revolutions.
Yeah.
And they started destroying it as early as the early 1600s. But one thing that was really neat is, they were talking about it was an armada of 8,000 ships. And that the ship that the Admiral was actually on was so large, it could have held 10 of Columbus's flagships in one of his, and that it was such a big difference. I thought that was funny that when Vasco da Gama finally did make it to Africa, the natives looked at his ship and kind of went, eh.
We've seen bigger.
You should have seen the other guy's ship. That was a ship.
Well, that, and I think it was the Confucius period they were going through where they decided to shut themselves off from the rest of the world and destroying outside knowledge.
Well, as Judge Judy says, if it isn't here, you ain't got it. Or no, if you don't have it, it doesn't exist. And so, you know, I would totally expect that if you had that big of an army, or excuse me, navy, it would have sailed to Africa. Not a problem in the world. Totally believe it. You might have even crossed the Pacific up near Alaska. Totally understand, totally believable. But like I said, there were already people in North America. They weren't writing anything. They were cavemen at that time. But, you know, there were already people here. So it had already been discovered. The idea is discover it, settle it, document it, and stuff like that. And that's what they didn't do.
That's why I said in the story, I said, quote, official discovery.
Yeah.
Official, what does that mean exactly? Documented, the first dude that actually stuck like a flag in the dirt? Or what does that mean?
Well, like so. I said, Oot's cousin, who was also named Oot because they were all named Oot.
Was he related to the other Oot?
Yeah, they were all related to each other. He did the first real estate development because he actually dug a latrine in the New World, and he was the first real estate developer.
I thought that was terraforming.
Terraforming? he was the first terraformer.
Actually, the new theory is because they're able to test genetic markers and find out where various North American Indian tribes originated from. And they've actually found that that North American Indian tribes along the East Coast up until the Appalachians, thank you, are all come from Europe, whereas all the Indian tribes west of the Appalachians, they come from Asia, which has gone against traditional thinking. They think that they just came over on the land bridge from Asia and down. It's very interesting.
Well, they have, it's the Clovis period, they call it.
No. Clovis period was much earlier than this.
No, but the Clovis period is where they're using that information to choose, or to prove, and I'm using quotation, finger quotes, that Europeans came over there is because in some areas they used totally different stone articles than they used in other areas, and those matched specifically, I believe they said, the French area.
No, you're confusing it. The Clovis people came here, and they were replaced by these two groups of Indian tribes. The Europeans that they're talking about were established later than the Clovis people. From what I understand.
I heard them happen at the same time, but that could very well be just my mishearing of History Channel.
Well, if it's on the History Channel,
it's got to be fact.
It is the History Channel. How can you argue with that?
I had my DNA, or my brother did, mapped. And where our Indian tribe started in Africa or something like that.
Oh, yeah. You go pretty far back.
Yeah.
There was a private firm. They'll still do it for genetic tracing of genealogy.
Can they trace you all the way back to, like, Adam and Eve?
Now, that would be something.
Yeah, that would be something.
I don't know how far back they do go, but, yeah, they'll go back.
That means I'm related to you.
Yeah.
And you. And you.
Yeah.
And you.
Okay, updates. So, Lens Magazine, who's been reporting on the $2 Jenny sheets, has reported yet again that the 20th pane has been found. It was reportedly purchased in the small town of Zanesville, Ohio, which is as close to the lightning strike as you can get, because the town takes up exactly 12.14 square miles and boasts a whopping population of 25,000 people. This is proof that the uninverted panes have, in fact, made their way all over the country. And I understand Scott's even been there. It's a pretty small town, no?
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, how the heck did you find Zanesville, Ohio?
Well, I went to college in Cleveland, and as you can imagine, going to college in Cleveland, there were many local people from the area that came from surrounding towns, and I knew people from there, and you know, take a weekend and go home with them. And since I was from out of state, they, you know, they'd drag me to their home for a weekend away from school or something like that. And I got to visit a lot of little towns around Ohio.
Did you find any inverted Jenny sheets while you were there?
No. But I did meet Orville Wright.
Oh, okay.
Really?
I love his popcorn. God, I love his popcorn.
You read my mind. I was going to say that.
Wrong Orville.
Yeah, there's an Orville Wright Jr. who...
He's thinking Orville Redenbacher.
No, I know who he's thinking. I'm still stuck on the Orville Wright because his son just passed away recently, didn't he?
I like his popcorn too.
Oh, okay. Forget it. Just cut this entire section out.
No, that's fine. It was just on TMZ. They found Ernest Hemingway's granddaughter to see if she was aware if Angelina Jolie had purchased her grandfather's typewriter that he used to write one of his novels.
Fascinating. So
people will hang on to famous family names as long as they can.
Oh, let's mention something about the Kardashians.
Oh, wow.
Just so we can say that we're like mainstream.
You're trying to boost our Google ratings.
There you go.
Kardashians need to be put on American stamps.
There you go. With the Zamboni.
Well, in order
you have to die to be on American stamps.
I was just about to say that. That's messed up. Uh-oh.
That was the most subtle stamp joke I think I've ever heard. That totally just whoosh right over everybody's head for a minute. That was great.
Oh, boy. All right. So our stamp stories this week want to focus on Thanksgiving memories of holiday stamps and covers. I actually found, when I was looking up Thanksgiving covers, this, that, and the other, most of them are from USS ships. They make special cachets and stuff like that, saying it came off a ship, a naval ship, or a mission. Some of them were for, like, the exploration of the Arctic and stuff like that.
Well, I have to jump in with the poultry industry stamp then, because clearly that has to do with Thanksgiving in a big way.
Gag.
Scott number 968, you mean?
Scott number 968.
The famous brown rooster with the little egg.
This is a collusion.
There
you go.
Well, I know Jessica picked up, accidentally, we were going through, digging through a box of covers at our local stamp shop.
Accidentally digging through a box of covers? That sounds pretty intentional to me.
What we found accidentally, wow, purposefully digging through a box of covers. Stashed in the middle of a whole bunch of Transportation Series 1980s First Day covers, we found a stack of First Day covers of the first Christmas stamp. So we bought a handful of those, and Jessica liked them, and they went in our cover book. I don't remember the Scott number, but I remember it's a green and red stamp with a wreath on it, and I believe a candle or two. I think it was from the early 60s, so it's not that old, but it's just kind of neat.
It's
the first one. You
block
know?
Of four.
Just at random. Hey, cool, check this out. And in fact, we had just been talking about it and had just learned about it maybe a day or two prior, and we're going through and went, hey, Jessica, is this what you're talking about? That's it. That's a stamp. So we picked up two or three of them, I think.
That's interesting that that's the first Christmas stamp. You'd think that they would have put one out earlier.
The seals.
Oh, the Christmas seals.
Oh, Christmas seals.
They're not semi-postals.
Yeah, they came out in 1917.
17,
yeah.
No, I think they were before that. There was one from 1908.
Yeah, that's right. That sounds right. As I say, I think I was calling out the date from like the Jenny stamp or something. So, yeah, Christmas seals have been around for a long time. That's true. That's interesting that seals have been around for that long. It took them almost 60 years to catch up.
Well, I know
this is a good idea.
If you look for, like, postcards.
Yeah.
First postcards with Santa on them that really looks like Santa came about between, like, 1908 and 1912.
You mean after Coca-Cola's big advertising campaign?
Well, that was a little bit later when you had... because in, like, the 1908 to 1912 period, you postcard collectors will look for brown Santas and green Santas because Santa just wore whatever he wore, and they'd collect different colors. It wasn't until, and I forget what year, I think it was, like, 1915 or something like that, Coca-Cola made the jolly red guy with the white trim, and from that point on, Santa was red with white trim. But before that, he wore all sorts of stuff.
My favorite's Santa driving a car.
Well, if you think about it, Santa must be the best stamp collector because he gets letters from all around the world asking for presents. Yeah.
That's a good point.
One heck of an international collector.
Exactly.
Yeah, but his collection only starts in 1960-something.
Whenever department store, was it Macy's that started telling kids to write to Santa for what they wanted?
They still do.
Well, of course, but it had to start sometime.
Yeah. They have a kiosk every year where you can write a letter to Santa.
Oh, yeah.
But we need, like, a Krampus.
Oh, no.
Okay, what's Krampus?
If you were good, Santa would give you a gift. And if you were bad or not good, Krampus would throw you in a bag and basically kidnap you. And he was, like, the not nice guy.
The anti-Santa.
Yeah, and you
will. If you're from the Netherlands.
Northern Europe, almost all in Northern Europe. And as a matter of fact, they call him, he has a second name, I forget who the other one was. But if you were bad, you got taken out.
You got Krampus.
You got Krampus.
There is some sort of pop culture reference to that in the last 10 or 15
American
years.
American Dad.
Oh, it was American Dad episode. Yep. That's right.
All about Krampus.
They did do a Krampus episode.
Still creeps me out. Because it's a kid's story.
Why? No, that's not a kid's story.
It
Simpsons is.
Simpsons
is not a kid's cartoon.
It's right up there with La Llorona and stuff like that.
No, Krampus was totally a kid's story.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Krampus, yeah. American Dad, not so much.
Yeah, and very politically incorrect, of course. I know a lot of stuff about the Holland Christmas and stuff, and he didn't have elves, and he had 10 little black people who worked for him.
Oh, boy.
And then he had Krampus, who sort of worked for him, and then he dressed every sort of way. He didn't wear the red with the white, but he would come ashore in a boat, and he would throw candy to people. I mean, literally throw candy at them, which was kind of cute.
Okay, our expert topic this week is forgotten rarities, which is inspired by a story Scott told me about a classic on cover.
Refresh my memory.
It was a certain plate position, and you were like, oh my goodness, look at this plate position.
Oh, is that the number 5?
It was some kind of weird subcategory.
There. Oh, I see. Yeah, I think it was up in San Francisco. I forget. Was it Pacific 97? A guy was going through a cover box from a well-known dealer, and he found a U.S. number 5 on cover. It was missed by the dealer, and he paid less than $100 for it. He turned around and got it certified, and the dealer lost it when he found out. Guy turned around and sold it for many thousands of dollars.
Now, I heard the story slightly different. Gary Posner was the dealer, and it wasn't a cover. It was in his.
It was in his discount. His half price box.
Half price box,
and he sold it for $19.95.
Yes,
the top margin and the bottom margin were chopped off, so you couldn't see that it had full ornaments at top, full ornaments at bottom. What you could see was the double transfer. U.S. number 5 has a very pronounced double transfer. And he found it, and he sent it off, and he got it certified, and he negotiated the cert cost because he couldn't afford the cert cost because it was such a valuable stamp back then.
Do you have any idea how much he did pay for the cert?
Yes, he negotiated. He supposedly, the cert was going to cost $500, and he paid half price, I believe it was. And he didn't sell the stamp. He still has it in his collection.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Good for him. Yeah, that's what...
I don't know. I like my story better.
That goes back to stuff we talked about in earlier episodes. Would you get rid of it just because it costs a lot of money and you paid a little bit for it?
Well, I found...
You didn't.
I did.
Well, bringing that up, I did find again, we're getting really into the weeds, a U.S. number 25 with inner frame lines crack plate from plate number 5 on cover. The only one known. It cataloged at the time like $500, and I sold it for $1,000. And, I bought it for nothing. Today, I sure as hell wish that I had that cover, not the $1,000. I mean, it really, when you find this really neat, weird stuff, you just really wish, you would have kept it.
Well, I found something like that. I found a Perf Tenet bottom variety. I bought it as a normal stamp, and I turned around and sold it immediately. Wish I'd have kept it because the value skyrocketed the next year. But if I had it today, I'd just turn around and sell it.
It was Perf Ten of the, what, 511, I think? You said, yeah. Yeah, that was quite a find. I heard about that. And from what I understand, you found that by eyeball, right?
Yep.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
So I understand that Filipino stamps are also considered rare because of the... Why are they considered rare?
Well, the souvenir sheets. Republic of the Philippines, after the war, Philippine Republic started. And in the 1980s, they started printing souvenir sheets for their stamps, and they printed very, very, very small quantities. You know, some of these stamps are in quantities of, or souvenir sheets are in quantities of 25,000, and some are as low as 10,000. And for a large run from a substantial country that has millions of people and millions of stamp collectors, to have something that has a print run of 10,000 is really, that's not enough to satisfy the philatelic needs of the country, let's say.
Isn't that why early PRC, that's the non-reprint, actually worth quite a bit?
I mean, the reprints are starting to go up in They're value also, too, huh? Yeah.
Hello, I just sold a set of reprints on eBay. The Scott catalog says it valued at $42.50, and I was happy to get $15.50 for them. And wow. They were beautiful, completely 100% sound, good color. And I did some research on eBay before I put them up, and everybody who had put them up in the $35 to $50 category, not a single one sold. So
I was looking in the.
I think Scott's probably overvalued at this point on those.
Could be, although I'm seeing in the auctions that the reprints are, as large lots, are starting to go up. Because they're the equivalent of the U.S. reprints of 1876. Is that when?
No, 1875.
1875. All the 1875 reprints, those were all government manufactured.
Yeah, but a lot fewer of those were sold.
Yes. Yeah, but how many reprints are there of the Chinese stamps? Maybe millions?
No. They vary somewhere around, well, they vary by issue, but well over 200,000 to 300,000. The hitch is that 100% of it went into philatelic hands.
Yes.
So, and that was a thing that I was going to talk to or was talking with Jessica about, you know, what's a very common stamp. Well, you can print a lot of a stamp, but they get used and thrown in the trash. If you have something like these reprints where they print a relatively large amount, but 100% of them go into stamp collections, they're going to be very common. And that's what happened with these reprints.
I've recently been looking at condition rarities. Steve Krippy and I have been talking about this quite a bit. He has his buy list that he's putting out where collectors have asked him to find various stamps for them, and they've given up trying to find them via the auction house or the traditional route. And he has actually had to resort to putting prices, many of them at full SMQ out there, so he can buy some of these items in grades of 95. There's only one or two of them that exist. They are true rarities. Even forgotten, ugly stepson of the Fourth Bureau issues, the Perf 10.5 Rotary Fourth Bureau issues. Well, those are quite rare.
But sometimes people don't even bother submitting those because they think they're not worth submitting. They don't realize how hard it is to find them in those extremely high grades, and so they just don't bother even looking. I mean, they're out there, and there aren't a lot of them out there, but they're out there. It's like finding an inverted Jenny. You can pay $20, $30, $40 for something. You're paying way over catalog. But if it grades out, you might be able to sell it for 10 times what you paid for it.
But I've looked at sheets of, there was a lot auction of 634, so the Common 2 Center. And there were hundreds of sheets. And I don't think there were there's the possibility of there being a couple hundred, but even finding a 95 or a 98 per sheet is incredibly rare.
Absolutely.
Whereas you look at some of the flat plate issues, and 95s are quite common.
They're much easier to find.
They're much easier to find than these rotary stamps. Rotary stamps are very, very difficult.
That's, again, a smaller margin also drives that. It's more difficult to get a well-centered stamp with those tinier margins.
Well, it's not just that. They have very large margins top and bottom, very tiny left and right. But that's way too technical.
Well, this is the expert section discussion.
Oh, well, then I <good. laughs>
rescind your comment.
We're talking about Scott number fives and 25s and the difference. Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. Well, getting back to the Filipino sheets, the souvenir sheets, a lot of people are used to buying stuff for a percentage of Scott catalog. 25-30%, and you get to some of these sheets, and I think they're terribly underpriced in Scott's for the amount of the press run. But you have, people saying, "Hey, why is this? At full catalog? I'm not used to paying full catalog." The person just, the one particular dealer just says, "Go find one somewhere else," and of course you can't. So I totally understand where Mr. Crippy is coming from with, just having to flat out advertise. You have a need for this stamp, and if it's out there and there are three of them, please, one of the three people, give me a phone call.
I thought his comments in the new SMQ were really kind of eye-opening. Is titled, "Where Are the Graded Stamps?" They're just not out there in the marketplace. They're in people's collections, and people are looking for more. Mm. And they're just not being submitted in enough quantities to be for the desire in the marketplace right now.
Well, I think we're going through an interesting transition. We're definitely in a certain hoarding mentality right now where people are just holding on to what they can find. And I'm seeing collections starting to be built, whereas even a year ago, you still saw several collections come on the market. But what's also interesting is the population report is finally coming into its own. It has over a decade of data now, and it's become incredibly useful. If you have something that has a population of 2, 3, 4, 5, that's an incredibly scarce item, and you know that people have been trying for over a decade to find that item.
Yeah, that's a good indicator.
Yeah,
especially for the classics.
No, I think for many of the issues, assuming that there's a what you have to do is look at the total population of the item. If it was issued in the millions and there's only, say, 200 of the stamps that have been submitted, well, you know that there's a really good chance of there being some hundreds still out there. But
on the other hand, you also know that people try to pick stamps that are worthy of being graded when they submit them. They don't just randomly submit everything.
Right. So, well, which is why you see spikes, like even on.
Right. So on an issue where you see, well, they've only graded 200 in the last 10 years. Well, that's because, the rest of them have been looked at and or the ones that have been considered have been deemed not worth the expense of grading.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. Like I would venture to say every number five has a cert, but not every number 113 has a cert.
Or 880, my favorite stamp.
Or 888, yeah.
I thought your favorite stamp was a chicken stamp.
Yeah, that's true, chicken stamp.
Boy, it sure is hard to decide.
Hard to keep up with you, Cash.
Well, no, 880 is just an interesting stamp for me because finding them in large enough quantity to try to grade is difficult because when the postage rate went from 15 cent to 18 cent, all the first day cover companies took that 2 cent, is a 2 cent famous American stamp that has John Philip Sousa on it. And the first day cover companies all said, "I want that stamp as the makeup rate." So you had the 13 cent stamp and a 2 cent John Philip Sousa rate. And they burned lots and lots and lots of stamps. So that today that stamp is of the set, that is the most uncommon stamp to find in a high grade. And it's probably the most uncommon stamp in the set.
Although absolutely.
It's not saying a lot because there's still millions of sets out there, but, probably what it is, there's a million of everything else in that stamp, there's 100,000 of them. So you could, at some point, that's going to be the key value.
No, it already is the key value. There's two. There's that stamp, and then there's one other, and I can't quite remember it off the top of my head, that are the most difficult stamps to find. And it's not just because First Day Cover companies burn through them. That's not the only reason. That stamp has notoriously small margins, and it is compared to, say, an 893, which if you compare the two side by side, has huge margins. It's easier to find that well-centered. For some reason, larger margin stamps are easier for your eye to spot well-centered. The smaller margin stamps are very difficult.
Well, I think that's also because minuscule variations on a small margin stamp make up a larger percentage,
whereas you're right.
The same difference in size on a larger margin stamp is kind of not as obvious because there's more a margin there to work with. And plus, so your eye doesn't pick it up as well.
Plus, that set has actually a couple of stamps right around that area. They have very poor perforations. Perforations didn't get punched very well. There's a lot of chads and missing perfs and blind perfs and things that kind of plague the middle of the famous American issue.
Well, that and when they applied the gum breakers to those issues to keep the sheets from curling in the drawers, there were times when they had the tensioner on the press set a little too tight, and it actually broke the paper fibers of the stamp. And some you get a good angled lighting, you can actually see those. It looks like creases, and they when you dip it in watermark fluid, they dip dark like creases, and they dry first like creases do because those paper fibers are broken. But it's visible on the front of the stamp, but not on the back of the stamp.
I think you see a lot of that, not just because the tensioner is ratcheted up, but also the paper used from, I want to say all the early Fourth Bureau rotaries on, all of the rotary issues, the paper was very brittle.
Well, you see it starts in the Fourth Bureau rotaries and it runs through the Fifth Bureau, which is the Prexy set.
Right.
And you see it all through those, and you see it on some... A few of the commemorative issues, you see it on special deliveries, and all of those things through that period have the potential to have that characteristic as a production fault. And so a lot of times you'll say, wow, that's a greatly centered stamp, but then you look at it and you go, wait a minute, too bad. It's got this production issue that makes it not worth grading.
I might also have something to do with the gum breaker on it. When the gum dries, I think it tends to shrink the paper a little bit. And so since it is so brittle, the place that it gives is right on the paper.
Yeah, but generally it's not right where the gum breakers are. It's generally offset from the gum breakers, a slight distance. It's not exactly in between the gum breakers, but it's not exactly along the gum breakers either. It's just kind of parallel to the gum breakers, which is really an odd place for it to do that.
Another rarity I found that I didn't know existed was the red plate 77 in the Penny Red series from 1858 to 1879. Do you guys know anything about that?
Yeah, well, it's from Great Britain. We don't care.
No.
That is quite a rare stamp.
I collect a U.S. or a Great Britain number 33s.
You collect everything.
I have a large plating of them, and I have stamps from plate number 225, but I have none from 77. It was used for such a short period of time, and there's a whole bunch of theories as to why. But basically, it was used very short, and they don't exist very much.
So where do you find a plate number on these stamps?
Well, on the tassel work on the left and the right side, it's a red stamp. It's got tasseling on the left and right. On the bottom, it says one penny. Inside the tassel work, they sort of hid the plate numbers. So every stamp has a plate number on it. Every U.S. or every I keep saying U.S. Every Great Britain number 33 has a plate number in this tassel work, and sometimes they're very difficult to see. Sometimes they're very difficult to figure out, but they all have them. And number 77, I think there's only a couple handful of them out there. and they catalog thousands, or they sell for thousands when they come up. And finding one of those is a real rarity.
That's the reason why you go through a pile of 1,000 of those stamps? Just trying to find one?
Well, I go through them because I'm looking for all the plates. You know, I have the later plates, the 200 plates I'm still working on, but all the earlier plates I have finished. And, you know, you just...
Except for 77.
Except for 77.
He hasn't started that one yet.
That one is a blank page, yes.
Mm. So how many plates are there then? There's no number?
150-something, somewhere around 150 plates.
Well, you said it went up to 200 and...
Yeah, I'm confused.
25.
225, yeah. It started at 70.
Oh, they didn't start at number one then.
No, yeah. number one was the Penny Black.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, number 11 was Penny Black. Later on, they
Penny Black had 12 plates.
The numbers went fairly consistently. They broke their pattern sometime. I don't remember when. And then everything is numerical. And as a matter of fact, if you can find the plate number on the stamp, it identifies a stamp. You know, there is no stamp identification of Great Britain there is no mystery of identifying like there is in the United States with, you know, the flats and everything like that, and the different types and the papers and everything. If it's got this plate number, it's that stamp, which makes Great Britain a pretty cool country to collect also.
The early stuff.
The early stuff.
So then plate 77 is the first plate for the Penny Red.
No, I believe 73 is the first. Ah.
Boy, how messy.
So you have a 73?
Yeah.
We don't have a 77.
No 77s.
Wow.
Anybody has a spare 77 laying around, you know, they could they could just send it over here.
Or 225s. Send those over too. Everything's appreciated.
So what's up with the 225?
It was just toward the end of the plate run, and so it
was the last plate. That was the last plate, right? Yeah.
So there's no 226.
No.
If there is, there's a problem.
It's a fake.
Yeah. So what do you guys know about quirky rarities? Like, I found some Swarovski crystals. I guess they're not as rare, but they're quirky.
Swarovski crystal what?
Stamps.
Oh.
Yeah.
They have crystals on them.
I was reading there was
crystal dust?
No, crystals.
There's a coffee and a chocolate stamp. Coffee smelling and chocolate smelling.
There's also a
scratch and sniff.
And we were commenting when the chef's stamps came out that they should make the gum flavored.
Well, there's embroidered stamps. There's all sorts of stuff. There's wood stamps, things like that.
I was talking to Henry Gittner a little while ago, and he was telling me that on some of the smaller countries, the production runs are in the low thousands, like 6,000, maybe 5,000 on countries like Cook Islands. Those are by definition rarities. The only problem with that, and it's just a small problem, is the collectors are rarer than the stamps themselves.
Yes.
Well, ones I like are the records.
Oh, from
Tonga,
yeah.
Oh, are those great big round monstrosities.
They range anywhere from maybe 1.5, 2 inches around to 6 inches in diameter.
Salad plate.
Well, they came out. Yeah. They came out with another set.
There's two sets.
Years later, that was a CD.
Well, the
But
I haven't seen those.
The greatest thing
I had some at some point.
Steve Patillo, at his stamp shows, he has two exhibits out a lot of the time, and one of them is a hinge exhibit, which is really cool. It shows all the hinges. The other one is he has the records stamps in their original little shipping pouches. And so he has actual, the way they were sent to the post office. It was very interesting how they packaged them and everything. But it's a very thick collection.
I had a set at one point, and I thought it was really cool because I stuck them on the turntable and listened to them.
What the heck?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
How does that work?
Are there incantations backwards in Latin on them or something?
No, they play like the Tongan national anthem and things like that.
You serious?
Yeah.
They actually. So when you say record, you mean they actually play music?
They are actual records.
They are actual records. Yes.
Yes.
Well, it's the same with the CD. But
mind blown.
You pop that in a CD player, and it would play the Tonga National Anthem. Yeah.
I think the set catalog.
Okay, now I need a set.
I think that set catalog's like what? Catalog 700, and you usually find them in the 450 range.
What if you just want to buy the low value so you could just listen to the CD? How much does that run?
How about Faces on Mars? Let's just
that was a great
all right, quote, unquote, done.
Rarity that was that spiked and then became nothing.
Yep.
Cash is done.
Explain.
Oh, they put out a souvenir sheet, right?
It was a set of souvenir sheets. Yeah. I forget how many. I want to say six or so.
Yeah.
I think it was four smaller ones, two larger ones.
And one of them had a picture of the face on Mars that you always see in every place. And everybody thought that the fact that it had a face from Mars made the stamp more valuable. And it went up.
I think it shot up well over $100. I think it was.
I seem to remember it was hundreds. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they even advertised it in the Reader's Digest. They had it advertised.
I'll take your word for it.
Well, you know that one. They're trying to say that there's life on Mars. I want to know who took the picture of the Mars Pathfinder for that stamp.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, now you can buy that same set of stamps that was hundreds of dollars just a short while ago for about $25 on eBay.
I want the PRC that's monkey stamp. That's pushing it, but yes. That.
No, I think that's about what they're
doing.
Right now.
They're a bit more than that, but not a lot.
I think a patient person could probably pick up a set pretty easily.
I think if you paid $50, you're still overpaying by $50, but...
That's a possibility.
I found one of those in the collection, and it had some kind of a tin feel to it, or some kind of metallic feel.
I know. I don't know if that's from that collection. One? I know what stamp you're talking about. It's a U.S. stamp on a copper metallic sheet.
Maybe some gold foil?
The sheet's about this big.
Mars Pathfinder?
Yeah.
No, that'd be... Oh, I thought you were talking about
the $3 Mars Pathfinder.
Yeah, okay.
Cool looking stamp.
That's holographic foil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Someone completely destroyed it trying to soak it off.
Yeah, we have this one that's all wrinkly and destroyed.
I haven't figured out a way to remove them from the paper.
Well, right. Apparently the person who had this one before we found it couldn't either. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's just...
I don't have any trouble if with it.
You would get them and they're not all wrinkly.
Yeah.
You're better than I am.
I thought I'd have a stamp for postage, but you could clearly see the cancel on it. So I had to give up on that idea.
Those Tongan stamps.
That would be against the law.
Are there any documented uses of them on cover? How do you cancel a record?
Oh, no. You see them on cover all the time. The Philatelic Bureau from Tonga used them, and I see those covers quite often.
I think they're a little scarcer than you're implying. They were used on cover philatelically, but not very often, I believe.
Well, it could just be, the person I was dealing with is, he had a lot of Tonga stamps, so he got a lot of mail from them, and, in Arizona there's none. But I have seen them on cover. If you're into records on stamps, that's...
Somebody wanted to sell me a whole pile of them for 20 or 30 bucks at a show, and I wish I would have gotten them. Yeah. Dang it.
They are pretty cool.
We don't have a sound effect for that.
What else we got, Jessica?
That's about it. If you guys can think of any more rarities that people often forget. I have, the common ones, but they all...
The common rarities?
The common rarities.
Well, the common knowledge that they exist. list, and it's all the same thing. I'm trying to think of other ones that people may not know about that have been forgotten or...
Well, while you're thinking, I do kind of have a question. In other collectibles that I've pursued, we've come across something very frustrating in the past. You have people that... now, obviously, this is going to be harder with stamps that are over 100 years old, but when a new series came out, they made 100 of them, and this person would run out and buy 60 of them, regardless of cost. And they had no reason. They never sold them later. They just bought them, hoarded them, and hung on to them. And then when they died, the family was left with three gigantic roomfuls of drawers and drawers and drawers of this stuff that they just hoarded with no intent to ever resell. Does that kind of stuff ever happen with stamps? People that just consistently hoard things and there's no monetary reason. They're not trying to make money off of it. They keep everything they come across.
Occasionally, and every once in a while after they pass, the family will generally contact maybe a dealer or an auction house, and you'll see just massive amounts of certain items that you just never see come out on the marketplace at one time.
Well, I think that was the whole idea about buying stamps after World War II, when people bought sheets of 3- and 4-cent commemoratives, and they put them away thinking that these were going to be the next Zeppelin set, and they were going to get rich, or their heirs were going to get rich. And so they just socked away 2, 3, 5 sheets, whatever they could afford. And then they come out, but because so many of them were printed and everybody saved them, they're common today.
I think it's a slightly different than that. They weren't really thinking they were going to get rich, but the culture at the time, the Depression era culture, it used to be that if you bought a stamp at the post office, you could actually use it and it was still worth half of the face value. You could actually go and sell that, buy a 3-cent stamp. And if you had two of them, you could get 3 cents from a stamp dealer.
Well, but I kind of beg to differ. The hoarding of the 3-cent sheets, it really was people looking to make a bunch of money. They did sock them away. And there are articles, you know, talking to people at the time. And I know that they were in the Reader's Digest and Boy's Life magazine talking about 3-cent commemoratives and how they've gone up in value. And I, on a prior podcast, I was talking about it, how the mothers are the ones who saved them, because these magazines went to mothers. And they said, wow, I can save for my kids' college by buying 3-cent commemoratives. And today, of course, you can't buy anything with them.
I literally use very poorly centered 3-cent commemoratives as postage on packages.
Yeah, good luck. They're only 3 cents. You need...
You better be sending big packages. Exactly.
Oh, people get really colorful packages for me.
Yeah. Yeah, but 3-cent sheets, and even 4-cent sheets to a certain extent, have kind of had a bit of a revival. You used to be able to buy them for around face or under face in very large lots. Well, that's nowadays, they tend to wholesale for close to double face.
Well, that's because there's a lot more collectors now. I mean, we were talking earlier.
You also have a lot of collectors who are looking at sheets for... to break them up for grading, and they're looking for the better centered ones, and that's taking a bunch of those sheets out of the marketplace as well.
Yes, but you see,
but sheets, I see no.
You see sheets on eBay go for $10, $15, $20,
and that's because
there are more sheet collectors.
Yeah. There are also a lot more collectors. I mean,
blocks used to be the big thing. Now it's sheets, full sheets.
Oh, okay,
people are actually getting into collecting sheets.
Some people are.
Well, I think it has to do a lot with they're starting to put out all these mini sheets and the smaller format with only 20 stamps, and they have the designs in the selvage and all this other stuff. And so people are now collecting these mini sheets that are for the regular issue, or the regular issue has like 20 different stamps on the sheet, so you have to buy the whole sheet to get one of each anyway. And so now they've got, you know, 5, 10, 20 years of sheets, and they think, well, why don't I start working my way back and buy sheets and have a sheet collection?
Well, I think there's something special about the 3-cent sheets.
We're at an hour and 10 minutes.
Okay. Finish up my thought. We can hang up real quick. The 3-cent sheets are pretty amazing because those are the last of the sheets that had the really, really nice engraving. By the time you get to the 4-cent sheets, that beautiful, crisp, detailed engraving that you see on the 3 cents are gone. So you can have 3 cents, put them up on a wall. It's a beautiful piece of art. You put up a 13-cent stamp, it looks like it was...
I think that's the art director. It's the skill of the artist.
Yes, but you see that skill so much more in the 3-cent era than you do by the time you get to the 70s.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, there was an article in Linz that I read last week that they're bringing back engraved stamps in 2015. New engraved stamps.
Yeah, just one.
And they're actually, well, they're good looking, though. I like, they did a good job on them, I think. There's some decent detail in them, and it'd be nice to have engraved stamps again.
I think one of the stamps that was done in the last, I don't know, 15 years or so is the Grace Kelly stamp. It was a single color. It was all engraved. I really liked the way that stamp looked. I don't know why. I understand they're more expensive to produce, but the post office makes quite a bit of money on every stamp issue anyway due to retained retention revenue. But I think if you had better looking stamps, more people might collect stamps too.
Yeah, I mean, let's put it this way. As far as I'm concerned, with the exception of the inverted Jenny sheets, which were reprinted with the original plates as it is,
was taken from the original die.
Well, from the original die. I think these ones are going to come up next year, going to be the first new stamps that I've wanted since the I know I'm calling it the wrong thing, the Millennium sheets from the turn of the century.
Yeah, celebrate the century.
I mean, just they're going to look nice. And every once in a while, they come out. There's a white sheet recent in the last 20 years that has a blue engraved stamp on it. That the design, I think, was a rejected design from the first pictorial issue. It's a blue stamp. There's one sitting in the bin out there right now on a package. I think they gave it a $1 or $2 value. So, you know, that's a good-looking stamp. The things that they come out with that are engraved, they tend to do a pretty decent job of. And I for one, would like to see more of those to get people back into collecting pretty things again.
Well, since 92, they've been really bringing back a lot of the... about 92, they've really been doing a good job bringing back some of the most favorites. They did the Columbus, the Transmiss, with the with how the Transmiss was supposed to be issued, the multicolored, except they ran out of money for the Spanish-American War, so they went with one color. But, you know, they brought back the dual-colored stamp on the $1. They, you know, you have the
Pan-Americans.
The Pan-Americans, thank you.
Although I would have liked to have seen the whole set on those, not just the inverts.
Well, they're going after favorites.
Well, I understand that, but I think that the entire set, in addition to the inverts, would have been nice.
Yeah.
It would have been a lot better than those 80-cent stamps along the side.
They did.
I agree.
Or the Batman circles, the Batman discs. That, to me, is the joke of it. Is you know.
Try to get one of those graded.
Whoa. That apparent centering, that's going to have to deal with like pi and radius. Well, and
any of the circular Global Forever stamps that they've been issuing in the last couple of years, those are all going to be very difficult to...
Yeah, but the Batman stamp, that's different.
Not only to grade, but to find well-centered.
They just stuck those stamps on to try to get
more
stamps on it. I mean, I can't see that serving any possible reasoning.
I'm actually surprised those things make it through the mail because they're so small and they don't look like other postage stamps. I'm surprised they do make it through the mail.
Those stamps were designed to bring Kevin Smith back into stamp collecting.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you
go. Great. Now I'm going to have to go pitch this to Smodcast.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to end this episode. Again, go ahead and continue the conversation online at StampShowHT on Twitter, or you can email us at StampShowHereToday@gmail.com with your questions and comments. And as always, keep collecting.
I'm Brian Metz with OCStampStore.com with your stamp tip of the week. When you're looking at your 1-cent 1851 through 57 issue, the easy way to eliminate the more common stamps is to look at the sides. Types 1 through 4 all have complete side ornaments. Type 5, Scott number 24, does not. Make sure you listen for future tips where I describe each type. For more U.S. stamp tips, sign up for my newsletter at OCStampStore.com.
Hi, this is Tom Mills, H.R. Harmer Stamp Auctions. You're listening to the podcast for Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurse, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
to send up. Address unknown.